Hello and welcome to The Bulletin with UBS on Monocle 24. Each week we'll be hearing from the sharpest minds and freshest thinkers in the world of finance, taking you beyond the numbers and the hype and getting to the heart of the big issues of the day. This week we're talking about the Indian economy and the impact on its neighbours and indeed the wider world of the extent of its growth over the next decade. China's last 10 years offer one template for progress. So what are the key lessons from Beijing to which the policymakers in Narendra Modi's new administration in Delhi must pay heed? Paul Donovan, Deputy Head of Global Economics at UBS, is pretty clear in his advice to India on this point.
Don't do it. China's progress has come at a particularly high cost. The Chinese economy has roared ahead in many ways, but is lagging behind significantly in terms of environmental constraints as to its growth in the future, now becoming an absolutely serious, critical problem. Water issues, pollution issues, health issues are becoming too serious. China has had an increase and a decrease in standard of living simultaneously. I think for the Modi administration, what they need to concentrate on is the agricultural sector, basic standard of living for the mass of the population. In a democracy, I think they have to do that, and I think it is in the long-term benefit of the country.
Of course, what India should learn from China is very different, if you consider what Beijing would say on the matter. Here's the broadcaster and editor of China Dialogue, Isabel Hilton.
I think this is what China would say that India should learn, is that democracy doesn't speed up development. That's the message that China takes from looking at India. So if the Chinese want to build a high-speed railway, you know, they can pretty much order it done and it will be done because nobody can protest it effectively in China. If you try and build anything in India, you know, you have this fantastically lively civil society and everybody fighting you for years. Now, I wouldn't advocate the Chinese solution, but it certainly is a complication for India.
The impact of democracy informs this debate in India profoundly, as Milan Vezhnev, associate of the South Asia program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, explains.
People in India speak of this as the democracy tax, that India essentially sacrifices 2 to 3 percentage points of GDP growth due to democracy, which is to say, unlike China or, say, many of the other East Asian countries which developed rapidly under non-democratic regimes, India has to deal with NGOs, they have to deal with protests, they have to deal with courts, they have to deal with the rule of law. And so that hinders the speed with which development can take place.
That's a view from Washington, D.C. But what about in Delhi? What are India's prospects of following in the footsteps trodden by Beijing over the last 10 years, according to people in the capital? Rahul Bedi, a journalist there, explains.
People do look to China with a lot of envy, and the envy is basically pegged to the belief that China is at least 50 years ahead of India industrially, in terms of infrastructure, in terms of engineering capabilities. So there is a kind of a complex about the fact that India cannot really match China. And whilst there is optimism that India does have the capability to rival China, I think it's a little exaggerated. Even Prime Minister Modi, on his recent visit to the United States, said that for anybody to open a business in India, you need a minimum of about 35 or 36 signatures from various departments, which are time-consuming. There's a lot of corruption involved and a lot of bureaucracy. So people are fed up of this, and there is a desire for change, but the system is fairly hidebound in a sense, and it's going to take a lot on Mr. Modi's part to change this and make it work a little more efficiently.
The view of Rahul Bedi and his dog in Delhi, where reform is seen very much as the key to Indian progress. And that's a view that's echoed around the world. Paul Donovan from UBS again.
I think the problem with India is that when I sit in London in my office thinking about India in the abstract, I become very optimistic. And then I visit, and the optimism just sort of fades away in the face of stifling bureaucracy, which is, I still think, one of the great challenges that India faces. The other challenge, I think, is the fact that Modi is, in many senses, trying to pursue fashionable reform. He doesn't want to be seen as an emerging market doing 1970s-style agricultural labor reform, and yet India, as an agricultural country, wastes half of all the food that it produces. I mean, that is an appalling statistic, given the general health levels of that country. So I think that the reforms that are being pursued are not necessarily the most optimal reforms. And I think the reforms that are being pursued may very well die in the middle levels of bureaucracy in India.
A stifling bureaucracy could therefore threaten even a fairly ambitious reform agenda. But what of the other structural challenges? In Washington, Milan Vezhnev takes up the story.
Well, when you think about the driver of Chinese success, or really the driver of East Asian success from Hong Kong, Singapore, South Korea, Malaysia, and elsewhere, it was really based around a manufacturing-driven, export-oriented kind of model of economic development. And I think that one major constraint or difference you see in India is India's manufacturing sector is quite small relative to the other East Asian countries. So right now, manufacturing only accounts for about 15% of India's GDP. And there are sort of three major factors why that's the case. There are major constraints on acquiring land and converting, say, farmland to land for industrial purposes. That's number one. The second is there are very tight restrictions on labor, the ability, say, for owners of firms to hire or fire workers is highly constrained by very outdated labor laws. And the third is there are a lot of restrictions on capital. India has not completely opened itself up to foreign capital coming from abroad. So, for instance, in the defense sector, which is an area where people think there's a lot of potential perhaps for defense manufacturing, India today is the largest importer of arms in the world. It would like to manufacture more of those weapons at home, yet foreign direct investment is only allowed up to 49% in Indian defense companies, which has not been enough to attract capital from abroad. So land, labor, capital, constraints on each of those three factors of production, I think, has really hindered India's ability to replicate this East Asian model.
While the difficulties for India in replicating these models are plain, what would be the effect on the rest of the global economy if the country did nevertheless manage to make strides? We'll consider that question next. Is there, then, a potentially transformative effect of Indian growth on the global economy? Here from UBS in Zurich is the view of Kiran Ganesh.
As I'm sure we've heard, the problems that India faces in terms of transforming itself into a manufacturing hub are really manifold. But if we do look at the potential success of India, this does have a transformative effect on the global economy. I think if we look back to what China has done for the world, it has effectively exported relatively low rates of inflation around the world, and it has kept interest rates in places like the US very low by the Chinese government recycling its surplus into buying US government debt. Now, increasingly, as China becomes a consumer economy and less of an export economy, that downward pressure on inflation and downward pressure on interest rates is starting to go away from China. Now, if India can act as the second China and become a manufacturing hub, then that could have quite big implications for global inflation and global interest rates, and with India acting as a downward pressure on both of those rather than China. The view of the rest of the world on India at the moment is one that if it does want to become a global manufacturing power, then it will really need to change the way that it is acting in global trade talks at the moment, for example. We know that China benefited so much from joining the World Trade Organization, but India's primary role in world trade discussions so far has been, you know, really acting as something of a brake on a number of new potential reforms in global trade. Now, if it is going to act as a genuine global manufacturing power, I think it will need to cooperate more with the rest of the world and make more trade agreements than it has so far.
Kiran Ganesh, but how likely is India to undertake that sort of adjustment? Is there an appetite in Delhi? Rahul Bedi certainly believes so.
India does want to be a part of the sort of global food chain, as it were, or industrial chain. But unfortunately, because of the problems that I mentioned earlier about doing business, a lot of Indian businessmen, in fact, are going and investing in the West and as well as in Southeast Asia. An Indian businessman, the Tatas, they own Range Rover and Jaguar. A lot of other Indian businessmen are doing very well overseas, but they are very chary of doing business domestically purely because of this. And Mr. Modi wants to change this and wants to make India a part of what he calls look east, connect west, which means partner China, partner Japan, partner Southeast Asian countries like Singapore, Malaysia, and become a part of the global industrial chain with the US as well as Europe. So this is what he aims to do.
That's Modi's objective then. We'll consider whether he can deliver on that after this. As we've been hearing, opinion is divided as to whether the Modi administration can deliver sustained growth given all the other challenges. Milan Vaishnav from the Carnegie Endowment for Peace certainly believes in the country's potential.
India has a great potential to be a marketplace for exports which are being manufactured elsewhere, whether it's in the United States or other parts of the region. And we have seen trade increase between India and China, between India and the United States, between India and Singapore. However, those changes have not been as rapid because India has not been able to sustain its rapid growth. In the period of the 2000s were great years for the Indian economy, but due to a series of governance scandals, policy missteps, kind of a weak leadership that really wasn't able to push on reform, India's economy went from growing at almost 10% a year to growing at less than 5% for 2 years in a row, which is the worst economic performance in India in a quarter century.
Given the data then, and all the other barriers to success, it does make finding a template for success a pretty immense challenge for India. In fact, Isabel Hilton of China Dialogue thinks the country may be better off looking elsewhere, if not for a template on economic growth, then maybe for future alliances.
Well, interestingly, Xi Jinping's just been to India and there was a great deal of talk of how the two countries might cooperate. A lot of people are courting India now. You have a new prime minister in India who's a fan of the private sector, who promises he's a fan of business. He promises to change the way things are done in India. And certainly India has a, you know, rather slow-moving bureaucracy and often rather obstructionist. So there's a lot of interest in what might happen. China's interest is that, you know, for instance, the infrastructure firms and the people who build dams and do all that sort of thing have pretty much exhausted the home market. So they're very keen. They're very keen for a number of things. They're keen to go and build dams elsewhere. They're keen to build railways, for instance, in India. And they're keen to find perhaps new low-cost places of manufacture since China is now too expensive. So the Chinese are keen to have partnerships in India. My feeling is that the Indians are a little more cautious. China is a big, powerful neighbour. There's a history of hostility. And, you know, there are a lot of people who are coming around Delhi, you know, saying, please come and play with us, including Japan. And Japan might just be a more congenial partner.
In Delhi, there's no lack of conviction about what might make the difference for India as it navigates these choppy international waters. Rahul Bedi thinks he knows what might be the decisive factor.
Well, it's the entrepreneurial spirit of the Indian businessman. The Indian businessman, the small, medium and large businessman, is very entrepreneurial, very enterprising. And because he has had to do with very little, he's very innovative. So it is the innovation that the Indian brings to the table. And that is something that can be exploited very explicitly. And this is particularly so in the field of defense and military equipment. I mean, the kind of innovations that the Indian military has undertaken are quite phenomenal. And it's something that other countries can learn from. So there is an entrepreneurial spirit, there is a hunger, but what is really lacking is the animal spirit to push forward and make this happen.
Rahul Bedi there. Whether or not a lack of animal spirit defines India's economic outlook is perhaps a matter of opinion. But when it comes to an economic plan of action for the country, surely there must be a unifying view of the optimum path to progress. Paul Donovan, UBS's Deputy Head of Global Economics, doesn't believe there is any such easy fix.
This is the whole point. India is a very large, largely democratic country with very low education standards, with a very diverse population in terms of religion, ethnicity, in terms of social attitudes, and in terms of education standards. It's an agricultural country which is frankly very bad at agriculture. All of this, I think, creates a unique set of circumstances. If India looks somewhere else for the model, that model is guaranteed to be inappropriate for India.
So what does all that mean in terms of wider investment strategy both in India and across Asia? Here with a closing thought is Simon Smiles, UBS Chief Investment Officer for Ultra High Net Worth, with this programme's regular Client View.
I think the client interest outside of Asia in Indian assets still remains relatively small. It's seen as a niche investment opportunity. So while interest has picked up post Modi's win in the election, I wouldn't say it's a mainstream investment destination. The markets I find clients most interested in Asia today are actually those that are most exposed to global growth. So there's interest in Korean equities, there's interest in Taiwanese equities, for example. The path that India seems to be set on, with Modi opening up the economy and making it more exposed to the global economy, actually over the medium term perhaps serves it well to becoming a more interesting destination for clients' money outside of Asia.
Simon Smiles, talking to us this week from Washington, D.C. And that brings us to the end of this first edition of The Bulletin with UBS, setting the agenda in the fast-moving world of finance every week here on Monocle 24. Listen again and find out more at monocle.com or tune in via iTunes or SoundCloud. The Bulletin with UBS on Monocle 24.